Welcome to the Nth Venture.
What can I say about Palash Soni, co-founder and CEO of Goldcast? I think this entire podcast is just one long advertisement for Harvard Business School and the crazy things that they're doing at Goldcast, a true masterclass in management and the implementation of tech, very sophisticated org chart that they're dealing with, and a very sophisticated technical project that they've gotten off the ground. Pretty impressive track record. So I encourage you to absorb, relax, and enjoy.
Palash, welcome to the Nth Venture. Thanks so much for hopping on, buddy. I'm excited to tell the story. You've got a pretty fascinating one, and I'm looking forward to digging in, sir.
So thank you, Sam. I'm excited too.
Usually what I'm curious about asking folks is, you know, you've got this wonderful new company that's doing all these fascinating things in the world of events and doing so online, et cetera, coming off the heels of what, $28 million raise. Fantastic. Very impressive. But maybe tell me about growing up. What was that path like for you? Obviously, you know, you had that HBS guy, had a lot of interesting roles early on at Boeing, et cetera. You know, what if you look back on it, kind of kicked off that path, maybe even before you kind of entered the working world?
That's a great question, Sam. So a little bit about my background, and that's, you know, important for this answer. I was born and brought up in the central part of India, which is pretty poor, right? But I get the entrepreneurial bug from my mom, and from on her side, everyone was what you would call like a small business owner, right? They had their little mom and pop shops that they would run, and that was the way they made living, because there were no corporates. It's only you either work for the government or you do this. And my mom was always like interested in starting her own thing, so she attempted a lot of things, and there was no economy to support that in that area. So it didn't fly, but I took the inspiration and I would say maybe the instinct to be a founder from her, actually. So like my first sort of attempt to do it was in my childhood when I got my hands on a secondhand video game, right? This was before PS in the late 90s. And then I would kind of rent it out for 15 minutes for 1 rupee, which is like a 70th of a cent, something like that. I would always, you know, tinker with things like that. And when I went for my undergrad as an engineer, I was always technically inclined, and I liked that. But after engineering, I realized that I want to be somewhere at the intersection of both business and tech, because I eventually want to start something of my own. So I knew I wanted to be an entrepreneur even in like 2007 to 10-ish time when I was an undergrad. And startups were not a thing at that time in India. Like our Amazon, which is Flipkart now, owned by Walmart, had not started at that time. So I think I've always wanted to be an entrepreneur.
Tell me about when was it that you moved to the States? How old were you?
Yeah, Sam. So I moved to the States in 2019 for my MBA, and I was 30 at that time, almost 30.
Wow. And so I thought it was a little bit earlier. So this is kind of new territory. So tell me about that experience of getting into Harvard Business School. Is obviously kind of this mythical place. You know, what was it like? What did you expect, not expect, kind of going through the program?
Yeah, great question, Sam. So the reason why I came for my MBA, and I was not like the typical candidate. I was slightly older, right? Typically people come in with like 5 years of experience. I had 7, right? And the reason why I came in was I wanted to start a software company in the US while being in the US. So it was a very specific objective. And I was working as a PM before, and I realized it's hard to build a really great business that customers would love if you are like 12 hours away, you know, time zone wise from your customers. And in my last job, I could never get to know the customers as well as, you know, our competitors in the US. So that's what prompted me to come. So I came in with that specific objective. So a few things actually in the HBS ecosystem surprised me, because I was told before that, oh, MBA is not, you know, probably the best choice if you want to be a founder. So I was not expecting them, but HBS is actually pretty good place if you want to do that. One is you meet a lot of people who are very different in their background and truly diverse, right? So there are folks who really care about, say, social impact. Then there are rocket scientists, right? Even those kind of people. And
who definitely don't, right?
Yeah. They are doctors and you know, you can name anything and people would be there and they really care about their profession and where they want to be. And I learned a lot from that, just having a huge amount of exposure in a short amount of time to different types of people. And I had not been to something like this, right? Like I was an engineer, so very homogenous in terms of, you know, the kind of people I interacted with in undergrad. So that was great. The classes were awesome. So I had never been exposed to that case study method of teaching, right, where you are engaging in like a discussion and that's how you get to learn stuff. So I loved the classes as well. I think one thing that was a little too much for me was just extreme extroversion that I think is common in B-school students and programs, that I'm not that big of an extrovert. Like one party a week is too much for me. MBA people do it every day almost. So that was something hard. But the last thing was that I got exposed to a lot of great things at HBS that I didn't know about, like the concept of venture studios, right? So I got an internship at SAP's venture studio, which is SAP IO. And I said, okay, if I don't have an idea by the summers that I can work on, I can go and figure something out at SAP. Yeah. Overall, it was pretty great. And I credit HBS for a lot of where I am, even though I was there only for 1 year.
Okay. So what I'm curious about, so you're going through this wonderful program, right? You're, you know, with the intention of starting something in the US, right? Kind of the mechanism to get there. So was there kind of an aha moment, or what was the kind of path to, I think I have an idea here. What did that look like for you?
Yeah, great question, Sam. So I came in with a bunch of ideas that I wanted to explore and I thought were good. And I met my co-founder, Kishore, just in the context of HBS, but just slightly before we got to the US. And so we were working together, exploring ideas. And in that like cycle through 3 or 4 ideas in the first 7-8 months, we realized that we need to anchor on one very important thing in our ideas, which is it should be a big market, right? The market should just be huge, humongous. That's important because in the last ideas, they were all in some spaces in HR tech, and HR tech is generally not like an obviously big market, right? Some spaces there are big, but it's generally slightly small of a market. So we said, okay, we'll anchor on that. And so this was before COVID. COVID was not even a thing. We started looking at events because I had some experience in events from my last job. So my last company was B2B, and we used to do events for our own Python. And I was also, and the company was a MarTech ad tech company, right? So I knew what B2B, you know, where events fit in the B2B go-to-market motion. I also knew how MarTech generally works, right? And knew the world of Marketo and Salesforce, which is kind of, you know, boring to most people, but I found it interesting. So we were looking at events from the perspective that it should be, it's a medium that has not evolved in the last 30 years. It has been the same, very less measurable, and there's generally an angst in the XX towards not having the idea of what, you know, events are bringing in. So we thought, okay, let's build like a thin CRM of sorts for events. And that idea didn't fly because that in and of itself is not a great business. We abandoned it and then we moved to some other things. And when COVID hit, we realized that this might be a great wedge into building something which solves that problem, but can be much, much bigger. So, and then when we were looking at this space, we also realized that there's actually not many players who are doing it. At that time, when we started looking at it, there were only like 2-3 startups who were tackling this idea, and there was no big company, which changed very rapidly in the next 2 months. But we said, okay, it's a big market, right? A genuinely innovative thing and solves a problem that we know, we understand, and the timing is right.
We started looking into like the history of venture studios and found Bill Gross, I think in 1996, started Idealab. And so he's been doing this for like a long time. Looked back over, I think it was like 300 or so like startups that they created, most of them crash and burn up. But he looked back to do a study of like how, you know, what variables were, you know, most important for them succeeding. And his, it wasn't, you know, as scientific as you would like, but his kind of conclusion was that it was not funding or the management team or the idea so much as it was the timing. I thought that was fascinating. And we've kind of, you know, I think we've similarly learned a lesson there, but I think your timing was particularly awesome. So obviously there's a huge technical component to your business, and I'm sure you guys are, you know, on the never ending feature development, you know, world. But what did that look like in terms of once you get kind of a minimum viable product, if you will, What did the business side look like? How did you go to market? When and how did you raise the funding? What did the team look like in the early days? Tell me about everything needed to get to those first kind of customers.
Yeah, Sam, that's a great question. And that was a pretty interesting and stressful journey in the first 7-8 months, because to raise money, we had to get off HBS, take time off, and not go back to the second year, because that was the condition that investors had put in, and we understood why that was the case. The second was that the market did become pretty competitive, right, all of a sudden. So what we didn't anticipate is that all of the offline events companies would also pivot into this space, which we should have, and we were a little naive not expecting that. So the market heated up pretty much, and the few startups that started had raised a lot of money, but we had a unique take in the market, right? We were like, okay, we are trying to answer the why behind the events instead of the how, and we'll build it very verticalized for the B2B marketer. So I said, okay, the problem we are solving is measurability, right? And giving B2B marketers the tools to kind of orchestrate their go-to-market around events. So we focused a lot on analytics and stuff and not on the actual user experience. And also we thought, what is the best person who will probably buy this? And we somehow decided seed stage startups, right? Because they are the fastest, and we thought, okay, maybe they'll value it. And what happened in that time when we were trying to sell the product, right? And there were all these other competitors who were raising tons of money, right? At that time, there were, I think, 4 companies that had raised anywhere between like 15 million to 500 million, right? And yeah, and then there were pivoters, right, from the offline event world that had raised money. So there were like 7-8 very well-funded companies. And we were not getting any traction from these startups. What we realized is that seed stage startups probably don't have a mature enough, you know, go-to-market motion to even care about this. So they said they would care about it, but they were not willing to pay for it, or they would always find some reason to not pull the trigger. So we said, okay, let's try bigger companies who actually have an events program, because we cannot convince someone to do events, right? Or convince someone by Zoom is not the right thing to do. So
you're selling them on less things, right? It's like, you already are sold on events. We're just going to make it easier for you to do.
Yeah, exactly. So we said, okay, let's talk to some bigger companies. And my co-founder Kishore, he's great at sniping into conversations, right? So he somehow got us conversations with a few event marketers at bigger companies, right? Which is companies like PagerDuty, Box, those kind of companies. And there was just cold outreach, just networked outreach to investors and things like that. And what we got as feedback is that our UX was not good. It was pretty terrible. That's the thing that they cared about first. And we had completely missed that in our product building process, because we said, okay, we'll provide data analytics integrations and everything, and we'll be fine. That comes second. So we overnight, within 4 weeks, actually had to completely redo our UX. It was pretty tough. Like, we worked 7 days a week and almost like 13, 14 hours a day and did that and went back to those customers. Finally, we had like one customer who was like, okay, I'll take a free trial. Let's do it. Then the main sort of moment that helped us get to the first like 5 customers was actually underscore our investor. They started using our product. They were like, okay, you have improved the UX a lot and we can absolutely use this. And they started using it. And then David Cancel from Drift, he was a speaker in one of their events. And this was like first 2 weeks of Jan in 2021. He said, wow, this is awesome. This is great. And he said, we would love to use it. And he took a bet on this and Drift was a great brand at that time, big company. You know, they had thousands of marketers coming to their event, but they still took a bet on us. That created the sort of virality for us to get to like 10, 15, 20 customers.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You do seem to have this inherently kind of viral product. So tell me about kind of the people side as you guys are trying to build this out. You know, you're what, almost 3 years in now, if I'm getting the math right? What was it like to start building the team out? Obviously, you know, you kind of know your co-founders at the onset. When was kind of like the first real hires? You know, what does it look like for you guys as you're kind of building out the team side? And, you know, I'm always fascinated with management and how incredibly difficult it is. And so tell me about kind of the people side and what you've learned or didn't expect as you're building out this team.
Yeah, Sam, that's still ongoing, right? So initially it was the three of us co-founders, right? And I had third co-founder Ashish, who was the CTO. And he was running the engineering team in India. So he's in New York, but the team was in India, and we were five people and just the two co-founders, right? And as we were starting getting traction, right, we had an intern who we pivoted into becoming like a support person. He started doing support, and then we realized we need customer success, right? Because there's something to do with those customers, and I could do that, but we started getting traction. Our first business hire was Stephanie, who was actually running her own startup before, and that didn't work out. So she was looking for the next gig, and she runs this community in Boston called Startup Boston. She was into events and she liked the idea. She liked the product. She had seen it somewhere. So she joined as the first customer success person, and then eventually built out that whole post-sales team of CS and support and everything else. Then when we started hitting more like 500-600K in ARR, and all of this was being done by Kishore, my co-founder, we realized we probably need AEs, right? So we hired our first AE at that time. And then eventually when we raised the 10 mil round, right, we hired our first set of, I would say, department heads, right? So we got a head of sales, or a VP of sales, a head of growth. So that was like our first team, right? These people, and then they started building their own teams underneath. What we got wrong there, I think, in the first part was that, or I would say we were still learning. It was a mistake, experimentation was that in our business, sales and post-sales are very closely connected, more than a regular SaaS business, because we have to, like, the product, once it's sold, it's like the value doesn't come directly, right? You have to first sell it, right? And then there has to be, you know, the CS motion to get it adopted. And then it has to feed back into sales. And if that doesn't happen, then a lot of bad sales could happen, right? Like, we could sell to customers who are just doing one events and they don't really have a digital events program, things like that. So that is something that we underestimated. The second thing is that initially, Kishore was looking after both sales and marketing, right? And then we continued with that for almost 1 year. And then we realized sales is like a infinite sort of vortex, right? It can suck any amount of resources you put in it. And he was not able to devote time to marketing, actually, and caring for the brand and, you know, focus on product marketing, things like that. We made that change and then eventually hired a CRO who could bring sales and post-sales together. So this only happened like 6-8 months back, both those changes. That's how the team was built. What I realized is that I think most founders, and including us, we underestimated at what time we should bring leaders, right, in the team. And we were initially very against doing that. We were like, okay, say we want to build a product dot, let's get junior PMs and then build the product dot. Or in engineering as well, we were like, okay, you know, we have a CTO and then let's hire engineers and then we'll run a pretty lean team. But that, especially in engineering, for example, at some point there was like 12 engineers and they were not senior, right? And CTO. And we ran into this like incredible glut where nothing would move, right? People were working hard, but nothing would move actually. Then we brought in a VP of engineering at that time to kind of set things up. So I think there is a time when everyone thinks, okay, now I need someone to manage this or build this. Probably you should hire that person 2-3 months before you start feeling that.
Well, I think it's interesting, and I like the approach of there's always an argument, right? It's like, do I bring in the head first or the soldiers, right? And it seems like, I don't know if there's a 100% right answer, but it seems like on plenty of cases, it's the right move to bring in the junior folks first and start demonstrating the effectiveness of it, especially like in sales. You know, if you bring in sales folks first and they're actually like working and it's making sense, and then bringing on like a VP of sales where they can just kind of take it to the next level instead of just like starting from zero seems to be an interesting way, both to make it easier to hire the head and a higher quality one, then they're working on kind of taking it to the next level instead of like starting from scratch, which I think is interesting. But one of the challenges is, you know, starting with like that junior layer, and especially if they've been there for a while, and then kind of like bringing somebody on top of that team can be challenging. Was that ever like a big challenge for you guys, or like bringing on kind of like a head of an area after they've been kind of like, hey, I've been here doing it, you know, I've got the incumbency, you know, and all this. What was that like for you guys?
Yeah, Sam, that's always a challenge in especially in the early stages of growth. What I found helpful is that I think it's many times to just avoid that awkward conversation with people who are now going to have a new boss, people would avoid it. And we realize it's actually detrimental. So we actually, before even pulling the trigger on anyone or even starting to look for the person, we would have an honest conversation that we think, you know, for instance, we need a head of product now. And I know you guys have been working well as a product team, but there are these things which I think a head of product could bring to the table, and I cannot manage the team anymore directly. So those conversations, if had with the right intent and the right logic, people would see through it. And I realized if they are not able to see through it, then probably this is not the right sort of setting for them anymore. So in our case, we were fortunate that in almost all of the cases, people were able to see through it that yes, we probably need a new boss, and then, you know, things are changing as we are transcending these stages very quickly. So
I think that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, the challenge comes in when there's like a big team, right? And so for instance, when we brought in a CRO, the team was between sales and post sales were already like 20, 23 people, right? That makes the process all the more challenging, right? Because so many people have to get used to a new boss, his way, his and her way of working. And so that takes time. And I think in that time, what I realized, I found best is kind of micromanaging the whole thing, to be honest. It's like, okay, I'll go to everyone, at least the managers and you know, in that team, and just ask them like what is working, what is not working on a weekly basis. And I would kind of be in as many calls I can be with the CRO, trying to kind of nudge everyone in that right direction very constantly so that they are able to meet in the middle without too much heartburn. And that is what I think has worked well for us.
But I love the fact that you said also the, you know, kind of separating the position from the person, and by like priming that ahead of time and saying like, this is what I'm hoping to achieve here, rather than like, oh, this is John, he is the answer to all of our, you know, like that makes a lot of sense. I think also what you're saying around, you know, kind of making sure, like giving them the support from you as a kind of onboard, you know, making that very clear. I think that makes a lot of sense. You know, you guys also, you know, kind of on the management track here, you know, you expanded kind of beyond that 20, 30 person limit where it's like, okay, I can't have one-on-ones with everybody anymore. I can't, you know what's going on in your life all the time anymore. What I guess would be, you know, something you weren't expecting as you kind of grew beyond that, like very intimate personal level, like 20, 30 employees to far beyond that, you know, what have you found to be really helpful to kind of retain the effectiveness of the organization, but also, you know, kind of true to the culture, et cetera? I mean, do you have any tips for founders out there as they're kind of passing that threshold?
Yeah, absolutely, Sam. So that did happen with us a lot because we individually were managing teams before, right? Or managing a lot of people. And then they eventually, you know, they built a hierarchy, right? A structure. And we realized that there was like people who would talk to me every day before are now talking to me like once a quarter, right? And that does have some kind of effect on how they perceive their role in the company and relative importance in their head, right? Which might or might not have changed, but that's, you know, how they'll perceive because now they are not talking to me or Kishore as much. What I found helpful in that case is actually being like super transparent about everything. So what used to happen is before when I would go into those calls, actually the fact that I would talk to everyone about the strategy of the company, the direction and everything else, that was something I think that kept the early like people really motivated, right? And that was the aspect that they wanted the most that was, you know, missing now because they were not talking to me anymore. So we started doing all hands monthly, and where I spend a lot of time talking about the company strategy, very transparently talking about the finances of the company, what problems we have, you know, things that we need to improve and things like that. I never thought that it would work because all hands is normal. We never used to do it because I was like, oh yeah, small company, you know, why do we need to do it? That helped a lot. And we have radically increased the transparency. Like every all hands, I talk about, like I give numbers directly, like how much do we have in the bank? How much are we burning? What do we need to do to avoid a layoff? Things like that.
As you guys have grown on both the people side, and what have you found to be, you know, interesting as you're playing with products? Obviously, you've gotten some wonderful traction on the product, but how do you guys think about the engineering you're doing now and you know, prioritizing kind of where you want to go in the future and like tying that into the longer term strategy?
Yeah, that's a great question, Sam. So our our vision has always been slightly, what I would say, beyond events, right? So the one thing that all of us really believe in is that every marketing team should be like a media company, right? And that's our sort of like Uber goal, help every B2B marketing team become a media company. And events are a way to do that, right? Where you share content, thought leadership, engage people. And that, like, podcast is a way to do that. And there are you know, lots of things that a marketing team needs to run that machine effectively. So now we are in a place where we have started exploring things that are not just core events, right? Things such as we generate a lot of content, right? We generate terabytes of content that's recorded on our platform, and marketers want to use them in multiple ways. So we are exploring things with AI and then, you know, new things that have come in to help them repurpose content in, say, different languages, different transcripts and things like that. One thing that has changed in how we were doing before and how we are doing now in engineering is that we used to be very hacky in the early days because we had to build. So our MVP was not like the MVP you would, you know, read in Paul Graham's article. It was like a fully built out product, because in our space, we realized that there is no, probably a really minimal product would not work. So it was like a fully built out product before it hit the first customer. And so we had to build a lot of stuff, and our team was good at building a lot of things, but we kind of went too far with it and hacked up a lot of things. So now we have radically improved, like, put in focus on quality. And it was tough to realize, but not everyone who used to, you know, be great at it before is a fit anymore. And so we have, like, kind of transcended that stage where, as product and engineering team, we are coming to that moment that we, you know, not everyone who was a rock star before in the previous world is going to be, you know, great at it right now also. So that focus on quality is huge, especially as we are going into enterprises. They don't expect any failures at all. Starting to explore all of these, like, new pillars, which are not in the core event space, is the other thing that we are focusing on right now.
Yeah, it's interesting. You've got a product that I would imagine is, you know, the uptime has got to be, you know, insane. If a marketer plans this huge, you know, event and no one can log in or whatnot, that's tough. That's brutal. Yeah,
it is brutal. Like, we have when there's the peak event season is going on, which just ended actually. It's like fires all the time. Even, you know, and in some events, if, like, one attendee is complaining that they cannot have, you know, they don't have audio or the video is getting stuck, it creates a lot of stress for the marketer, and then it, you know, transcends to us.
Have you guys, in terms of, you know, I'm fascinated on the management side of this business, because it's so diverse. I think in what your teams are doing, but the way that you've managed, I'm sure, has changed over time. Do you guys use anything like formal OKRs, or, you know, what kind of, like, systems are you using in terms
yeah,
of?
Yeah, great question, Sam. So we started with a very simple sort of, like, quarterly goals framework, where essentially I would set those quarterly goals and give it to the team. And I realized that that didn't work as well, because the teams, while they had high ownership for the company and, you know, they felt a real love for the product and our customers, because they were not involved in that goal setting process, or there was, like, too many unknowns, so we didn't, like, I just gave them some goal, they were not real, they didn't feel real accountability towards those goals. So either they thought, okay, this is probably too high and I will try to work as best as I can, but I don't really feel accountable. So that is one, like, fundamental change I have made in my process. And actually, there's a great book that helped me understand that this is a big problem, which is called Five Temptations of a CEO. And it's a clickbaity kind of title, but that's an amazing book. Can be read in, like, 1.5 hours. And that helped me realize, damn, I probably fall into, like, 4 of those 5. But the main thing was just making sure that the team, that we have had those, like, discussions and even arguments in that happen in goal setting process. And then everyone is involved in that. And that is how, like, true accountability could come. We started doing that and realized that we need an OKR framework. So we have just rolled out OKRs now. Where we have annual OKRs and only at department level are we doing OKRs, not individual yet. Yeah, we'll see how it goes.
And maybe the lasting contribution of John Doerr, you know, we'll see. So have you gone through, you know, this whole process? You know, I think you guys are one of the darlings of post-pandemic tech. I think it's fantastic. You've talked a little bit about kind of expanding beyond, you know, the tradition, you know, where you guys are now, but if you think, you know, further in the future, you know, is there anything else you'd tell folks about, like, hey, this is, you know, where we plan to go over the next, say, like 5 years, you know, helping B2B marketers be their own kind of media company? I think it's fascinating. Maybe add some more color to that, or anything else that is exciting for you in the future of what you guys are doing.
Yeah, for sure, Sam. So the reason why we anchored on this thesis and is traditionally B2B companies would be very demand-gen centric, right? Like run ads, like site leads, and very few companies. And if you look at tech, maybe there was 10% of companies who were running like real, you know, building their real audience, like Drift, for instance, right, is one of those companies. And more companies are trying to do that. But the traditional way was just sniping leads. And so we want to change that. We want companies to actually be able to build their own audience and not rely on, you know, lead lists and ads as much, and generate content with the right efficiency and medium, so that the content itself is one of their products, right? And that helps them actually build an audience directly. So that's the whole thesis. It's not revolutionary in that, you know, companies know that, but we are kind of driving that urgency that this is something that needs to happen. And if you look at other B2B businesses, which are not in the bubble of VC, that's 100% true, right? They absolutely don't do things like this. So our vision is to drive that change, and that will translate in product in terms of a heavy investment in content. Because if you look at events, right, digital events are essentially like a way to maximize the impact of content, right? You are either, your speakers are coming in talking about it, and then you are saying, okay, boom, this is, you know, the time when we all come in and we, you know, get together and talk about it. And it helps kind of maximize the impact of the content in the content lifecycle, which has, you know, come down a lot. So a lot of investment would happen on the content side. So because we generate most of that content, which is essentially video, we are now working on a host of tools to help companies repurpose that in, say, a podcast, right? Like this, something like this could have happened in a digital event where, you know, people would probably be asking us questions, and we could then repurpose it as a podcast, or you could dub it automatically in other languages and put it on your site for on-demand viewing, or generate transcripts from it. So we are doing a lot of these things to make it super easy for marketers to essentially generate content at the velocity and, you know, the relevance it's needed. So that's one. The second is continuing to invest in events, especially hybrid events. That is something that we have a lead on, and we'll continue to build. And the third is what I call like the backend layer of all of this, which is orchestrating go-to-market around this. Because the media company is not going to succeed if you don't actually generate pipeline out of it, right? That's like the tactical reality. So a lot of our product actually looks like a MarTech product, which is about integrations and notifications and analytics that is very specific to events and eventually, you know, video, audio content.
Yeah. So I think that's very helpful. One of the things I just too tempted to avoid asking you is about the generative AI side and, you know, how you guys are thinking about that, obviously transcripts and kind of NLP side, but how are you thinking about, you know, obviously ChatGPT is getting on fire, you know, how are you guys thinking about, you know, that side and whether and how you're going to be able to implement it?
Yeah, great question, Sam. And we do get pulls on a lot of those things, right? So for instance, so ChatGPT is probably not directly something that we could, you know, use or has relevance today for our business, but anything having to do with speech to text and text to speech is very relevant to us, right? So we get a lot of requests for dubbing, right? Many multinational companies want their content to be in multiple languages, and it's insanely expensive to dub content. That's one interesting application that we are looking at. We have design partners to help us through that, where we could use AI to dub. We view it as a great efficiency and cost-saving lever, and we are definitely investing in it. We are not like going all in and, you know, to give into the hype, but we are definitely investing.
Yeah, I mean, if you take one event from a global company into 80 languages or whatnot, you could see how that could 50% increase, you know, the engagement or whatnot of whatever it is. So the final question I usually love asking is, you've gone through a very interesting kind of launch here. One of, like I said, I think the darlings of post-pandemic world. Tell me if you could go back and tell yourself, you know, something while you're at HBS kind of kicking around, you know, these ideas, what's something that you know now that you wish you knew then?
So the things we got right, and then I'll come to what, you know, what I would have wanted to change was that we were very focused from the get-go, which actually helped us survive and grow, right? So we were always saying, okay, we'll build for the B2B marketer, we'll be verticalized. And that had a lot of implications on our product roadmap and how we actually use the virality in this business, because the virality in a purely horizontal events business is not as great as, you know, it would look obvious, but it's not. And so we made all of those calls and that really worked for us. But as first-time founders, actually, we were not very confident of those calls, right? We would, because VCs would always push back against, like, oh, you know, it probably was like, what is this verticalized play? I don't understand it. And the challenge that would come from fundraising again and again, right? And talking to a lot of VCs, we would take that to heart and would second guess ourselves, right? So we never really materially changed that direction, but probably we should have been a little more vocal about it and a little more confident about it. And so that's something that I would want to change. I think we always have had a good trajectory, a good vision that is now proving to be right. But I would not give in to those, you know, pushbacks, which are very normal, kind of stay the course more strongly.
Rock and roll, Palash. Well, thank you. Palash Soni of Goldcast, thank you so much for hopping in. I really appreciate it. I think some of the lessons learned here will be applied for many a founder. So I really appreciate the time, buddy.
Thanks a lot, Sam.
Hey, you listen, it's going down just like this.
This has been an Audley production. Thank you for tuning in. Have a lovely, lovely day. We'll see you next time.